having depressed you, hopefully, with these first few lectures of how bad everything is, I know it's sort of poor form to not kind of suggest, well, fine, idiot, what are you going to do about it, right? Like, what can we do about it? What can I do about it sitting here? So that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to offer a couple things in this presentation that's sort of like, why is the left doing this, and what can we do to fight back? And I should add, this is a more speculative part of the discussion, okay? Like, everything about this book, particularly because it's controversial, super buttoned up. I've got 1,000 references here, almost, you know, 70 pages of endnotes, so everything is really documented. I'm now going to get a little bit more just in the realm of opinion, and I'm just kind of making that disclosure, okay? Because I don't have a crystal ball, and God has not chosen to directly communicate reality to me. So this is my thoughts. I mean, backed in some facts, hopefully, but I just want to kind of give that disclaimer up front before I kind of go more deeply into this. And there we go. So it's okay to be white, and this is actually a little bit of an internet meme, both with the sign and you can kind of change the message on it. But hopefully the Protestants here will recognize this is Martin Luther nailing his theses to 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral. I think, as I mentioned to you guys last night, I wanted to call this book "It Was Okay to Be White." It's okay to be white. It was a little bit edgy for my publishers. So I'm going to read to you from the second to last chapter here, where I kind of discuss. And actually, sorry, it's the last chapter where I kind of discuss this to a degree. Apologize. I should have had this open right away. In 2017, seemingly out of nowhere, signs began appearing, initially around college towns, but later in other locales, too. Simple and unadorned, they read, "It's okay to be white," in all capital letters, with no additional information. The phrase seemed innocuous enough. In fact, it was identical to the one spoken by a minority executive, quoted in our entertainment chapter, who was encouraging whites to feel like they were still welcome in our multicultural wonderland. But of course, the signs were hardly viewed as harmless by the establishment. It turns out that the slogan was the creation of the PAUL, politically incorrect, channel of the trollish 4chan internet message board. The creators were trying to provoke and to create a dissonance between a seemingly harmless message and the anger it would stoke in our anti-white public culture. Anger that would expose the fact that, in quotes, leftists and journalists hate white people, according to the poster who generated the idea. Mission accomplished. The posters appeared at Harvard, Princeton, and many other prestigious universities, where they were invariably removed by campus officials, who condemned them as divisive and racist. They were also condemned by the Washington Post, Newsweek, the Anti-Defamation League, and across other organs of elite opinion. In Saskatchewan, the University of Regina's president declared angrily, "These signs have no place in our university." If indeed these tactics are meant to silence our work in diversity and inclusion, please know that we shall not be deterred. We will continue to engage our campus in critical discussions and work together to enact real change, pronounced the University of Utah's DEI office. Meanwhile, Tucker Carlson quite reasonably asked on his show, "Okay, so what's the correct position? Is it not okay to be white?" This was the entire point. Because we live in a political climate that is hostile to white people, the notion that it could be okay to be white, that whiteness is not something worthy of being condemned, is viewed by many elites as a hostile statement. These signs exposed that in brilliant fashion. Yet encouragingly, normal Americans do not share our elite's fanatical anti-white animus. In a February 2023 poll conducted by the respected pollster Rasmussen Reports, 72% of people agreed that it was, in quote, okay to be white. Among black respondents, 53% agreed, while 26% disagreed. And majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and unaffiliated voters strongly agreed. Savvier leftists, like the leader of Washington State University's DEI office, agreed too. Sure, it's okay to be white. It's okay to be African American. It's okay to be Latino. I couldn't have said it better myself. The question this book asks and attempts to answer is why so many American elites seem to passionately agree with that statement, And in this final chapter, we'll explore what we should do about that. So that's what I'm going to try to do now for the rest of this slide deck. And just kind of going forward from Martin Luther here a little bit. So here's a quote. I've got another typo. This is, again, sorry, 1.0 draft, and you don't see it until it's up there, from Joe Biden in 1975 when he was a young senator. He says, "I don't feel responsible for the sins of my father and my grandfather. I feel that I'm responsible for what the situation is today, for the sins of my own generation, and I'll be damned if I'll feel responsible to pay for what happened 300 years ago." Well, that one has certainly been shoved down the memory hole, although I was happy to retrieve it, and I hope that this book will retrieve it for more people. But I mean, I do just sort of use this, I mean, A, to show just how much our political culture has moved to the far left in general about this. That's part of the point of putting this up. Secondly, it's to show how much the elite just controls discourse, that a really provocative and relative statement like this has been completely buried. And I guarantee, had anybody seen this statement before I put this up? Not a single one here, right? And you guys are informed, interested people, and that's why you came out on a rainy Saturday morning in Billings to hear me talk about this. So that's the degree to which our discourse is being controlled, right? But this is here. That was what Joe Biden, you know, left-wing Democrat, felt totally comfortable in saying in 1975 about the question of reparations. And reparations wasn't even on the table there. He's just talking about a variety of advantage, you know, programs that would, you know, advantage one ethnic group and disadvantage whites as a result. So that was kind of what passed for mainstream liberal democratic thought 50 years ago. Not anymore, right? So just keep that quote in mind. That's, again, it's in my book. So a summary of my thoughts on this issue. I don't have a crystal ball, as I mentioned. This is a necessarily speculative discussion that I'm about to have. My core thesis, though, is that the left is creating an intellectual and cultural environment to justify the expropriation of land, property, and other wealth from whites while instituting a permanent regime of anti-white employment and legal discrimination. And so what I mean by that, I just want to re-stress this, because this is like the crux of it. As I say in the book, ideas do not appear in the political discourse like, they don't appear like Athena coming out, bursting out fully armored from Zeus's head, ready for battle, okay? They gestate for a long time. There's a reason why they come into the discourse at a certain time and not at another time. And we need to ask ourselves very critically, well, why that is. There needs to be what's called, I would argue, the left wants these resources. They want to take them away from the folks who have them, which, speaking really, really broadly, is white people, because obviously there's a lot of people of every ethnicity who have money. But that's broadly what they want to do. That's the people who, broadly speaking, created the United States. And they want to transfer them to a lot of these new groups that we just talked about, many of whom are coming in from immigration. But what they need is what I would call a legitimating or legitimizing ideology. They can't just, nobody's going to feel good if they just say, oh, we just want your stuff. We're going to take it. Okay, that's not going to work. So what you need to create is an ideology that makes everybody feel okay about that. And everything that I talk about in this book, and what I've tried to at least sketch out in some of these talks, is the elements of that legitimating ideology that the left is creating, so that everybody will feel like this is an acceptable thing. So if that sounds alarming or implausible, again, as I suggest, it's already going on, okay? And in many cases, it's at the margins of our popular politics, but a lot of things that started at those margins, particularly at the left-wing margins, they don't stay there, they're in the mainstream. If you were to look at kind of what San Francisco and Berkeley were pushing in the 1960s and 70s, not all of it came. I mean, some of it was just so crazy that it never could achieve escape velocity, but a lot of it became mainstream. I think I may mention this later, but let me just go ahead and the answer, and I talk about this in my book, and I just love to cite it as an example. In 2004, Gavin Newsom performed as mayor of San Francisco an illegal, there was no question about it, it's illegality, gay marriage in California, and everybody was up in arms about it. In 2015, a nominally right-wing Supreme Court in the Obergefell case declared that the universal constitutional law of the land. So that's how quickly things can move, and they can move against Christians, and they can move against white people, whatever have you. So I'm going to talk about inner parties and outer parties, and I talk about this in the book. This discourse is from 1984. They talk a little bit about this, although you'll see this used more generally. It's an idea, there's a small inner party that kind of controls things, that actually understands to at least some degree the broader purpose of this legitimating ideology that they're using. Now, some of them, because it's kind of such a yucky thing to do, don't like to fully admit it to themselves, but they're sophisticated enough political actors, they understand what they're doing. There is a much broader group, which is the outer party. And the outer party is kind of the mass of people out there, on the left in particular. They just think they're fighting for social justice. They just think they're fighting for good things. They're fighting for equality. They're fighting for all the things that we in this room would like, for the most part. We'd have moral disagreements about certain things on the boundaries, but we'd actually probably have a lot of agreement. But they're being fooled. They're seeking a fake version of these things. So this is not a conspiracy. There's no protocols of the elders of anti-whiteness going on. There's nobody in a locked room kind of with the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, scheming for how to do this. It's just a natural outgrowth of our 21st century politics. But nonetheless, it's really damaging. So let's talk about that. I've talked a lot here about expropriation, the notion that people are going to effectively try to expropriate resources. So there is a rich literature in political science and history on historical expropriation. I'm just listing a few up here. You have the Chinese in Indonesia, the Jews in Nazi Germany, the Tutsis in Rwanda before the Rwandan genocide, or during the Rwandan genocide, Indians in Uganda. I could have listed hundreds of these, okay? And it's usually a minority group of some type that has achieved political or economic power, and it's being expropriated of that by a majority, okay? I won't think it'll be this bad here. There's a lot of people sort of at the further edges of the right on this debate who kind of say America's going to turn into South Africa. And if you kind of pay attention to some of the anti-white violence that's happening in South Africa, or how very mainstream South African political figures are now saying kill the Boer in their chants, the Boer being South African kind of Dutch people, you can see a bad thing. Now, for a variety of reasons, I don't think that's going to happen here. Our demographics are just different. Whites are not in any danger of kind of being minoritized at the level that the whites in South Africa are. But it could still be bad, okay? And a great deal of interracial violence, and again, I documented yesterday how whites are disproportionately the victims, has a scarcely hidden undertone of racial revenge. Not all of it. A lot of it's just opportunistic. But if you search through the details of these crime reports a lot, there is often a racial element. Now, it doesn't often get categorized as a hate crime, which is a whole other interesting discussion about how our government works. But that undertone is often there. So risk factors for societal conflict. So there's, as I mentioned, there's a long tradition of these financially and socially successful but politically less powerful groups being expropriated. Multi-ethnic democracies are at particular risk. And by 2045, which is just 20 years from now, whites are going to be a minority in America, disproportionately older. Median age for white people is 44 versus 37.5 for Asian Americans, 34.6 for African Americans, 29.8 for Hispanics, and 20.9 for multiracial Americans. Sorry for the typos there. This was late night stuff. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about Ibram Kendi. I talked about him yesterday. Ibram Kendi is kind of probably the biggest guru of critical race theory. He's been the author of 5 New York Times number one bestsellers. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner. He's in the Time 100, 100 Most Influential People in America. And the reason why I mention this all is that, again, I hate it when people do this, so I just, like, it's really easy for me to pick the stupidest, most marginal guy saying crazy stuff on the left and try to scare my audience with saying, this is what's in store for all of us if we don't, kind of do all this crazy stuff. This is not that. This is a mainstream major guy with mass political approval. He runs a $40 million anti-racism institute at Boston University. So in 2019, Kendi called for an anti-racist constitutional amendment. And one of the core principles guiding that amendment would be that racial inequity, is evidence of a racist policy. So in other words, if there's ever a disparate outcome by race, it's automatically because of a racist policy. And America must, in quotes, establish and permanently fund a Department of Anti-Racism comprised of formally trained experts on racism. Guess what? They ain't gonna be calling me to be a formally trained expert on racism. The DOA, this is the Department of Anti-Racism, make sure no policies create, in quotes, racist outcomes, monitor those policies, investigate, and I've highlighted this, private racist policies when racial inequity surfaces, and again, and I'm putting this bolding so you won't miss it, monitor public officials for expressions of racist ideas. So again, because I don't want to be irresponsible here, I'm not suggesting that this is like going to be something the Democrats are going to enact next year. This is a bridge too far, probably for the next 20 years for a variety of reasons. But if you don't think something like this is going to come down the pike in at least some manifestation, I think you're also being naive about the way politics works. So an example of this is Ta-Nehisi Coates. Now, Ta-Nehisi Coates is actually a much more serious thinker than Kendi. I mean, he's actually an interesting guy to read. He's an interesting thinker. I mean, I don't agree with much of what he says, but Kendi is to me like a parody, and Coates rises above that. So reparations seemed hopelessly marginal. He proposed them in The Atlantic in a 2014 article. And when he wrote that, everybody was like outraged that he would, even on parts of the left, they're like, well, how could we do this? Now this is like a totally mainstream conversation, particularly on the left and in left-leaning jurisdictions. So we've had reparations already in Evanston, Illinois. In San Francisco, they're discussing, you know, hundreds of thousands per multi-million dollars per black San Franciscan. For a variety of reasons, it's not gonna happen quite like that. And I will get to why that is later. But these are being talked about. Boston, you have the same thing just this week. They're talking about it. And by the way, in the church being big supporter, not probably the churches that we're going to, but a lot of these really bad mainline churches and the historically African-American church as well. Also interesting to note, none of this is happening anywhere where we've had slavery, okay? That's not a coincidence. Where you have leftists is the predictive thing, not where you have slavery, for figuring out where the reparations discussion is gonna be happen. So what is likely to be done, and it's gonna be indirect more likely, is through social programs, control of institutions, other government programs, and control of government generally. So it's not gonna necessarily even be called reparations because it's gonna get people up in arms. They're gonna do a little bit more of what they're doing already, which functionally is a reparations program, and they're gonna call it something else, but it's gonna have that effect. So pure majoritarian democracy, for those of you, you know, who hear complaints about the US Senate and its power and the empowerment of minorities, and I mean political minorities in that sense, this is why we have this. Because if you have a pure majoritarian democracy where 50 plus one, you know, percent of the vote means you can kind of do whatever, you are simply creating the sort of outlet for reparations and expropriation. That's just a generalized rule. It's not specific to the United States. So let me just go through some trivial arguments against reparations. We shouldn't have to make them, but let me just kind of do them so that we have them. Civil War, which was fought ultimately to make the free the slaves, I mean, we could have a 5-hour long conversation about whether it started that way or whether it was for other reasons, but ultimately that's kind of, it was its fundamental thing. Cost over 750,000 lives, almost 95% of those were white. On a population basis today, that's 7 million. That's almost 1,000 times more than people were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. We can't even get a sense, I don't think, of like the havoc that the Civil War wreaked, not just on the South, by the way, but on the North as well. So there was a huge, even to the extent that I kind of ignore everything that I said yesterday, which I firmly believe from Vodi Bakum's book about kind of structural racism and not inheriting guilt, even if we ignore all that, there is a pretty big blood debt that was already paid. Fighting age men of the Confederacy, deaths may have been as high as 1 of 5, with countless more killed and injured, up to 40% killed or significantly wounded, and the Southern economy was totally destroyed, okay? And that was followed by a decade of military occupation. So, you know, a non-biased person might say that's like kind of a pretty significant repayment of a debt for a wrong. Again, I kind of reject this type of thinking out front. That's why I say we shouldn't have to make it. But I do, if you're dealing with somebody who doesn't accept our priors, probably because they're non-Christian about that, I think, you know, that's some argument you could use. So reparations are already happening by other names. We already had trillions of dollars of reparations, and they were called welfare programs or set-asides or quotas or affirmative action. And again, the kind of convenient thing about how these work politically is that in most cases, they don't need to have an explicit racial quota. Like, I'll just give you a sense of how this works, where, like, the people who are doing it understand that it has a racial incidence, but the word race or the concept of race is never introduced to it at all. So in the Biden administration, just basically they did, again, I talk about this in the book, but they messed around with the mortgage financing laws in a very kind of opaque way. And the functional result of that is that it benefits a lot people who have bad credit, and it hurts people who have good credit. Okay? Well, if you look at racially who is likely to have bad credit and have good credit, there is a big racial difference. Now, of course, there are tons of white people with terrible credit. In fact, maybe some of you in your past or currently have had terrible credit. So there's nothing that's overtly racial going on there, but the net effect is a big racial wealth transfer. And believe me, the Biden administration understands that. You know, they're going to dress it up in other things, but that's what's going on. Much of what we call reparations, or even what's not called reparations, but these affirmative action, has gone to people, and I'm typing African immigrants and Latinos here, who are not even distantly descended from those harmed, right? So a very successful Igbo immigrant from Nigeria, that's a group that has higher average income and education than the average white American, comes to America from Nigeria freely, and they're super happy to be here, and they get a bunch of advantages. Now, some of their ancestors might have been slave owners or sold people into slavery, but none of their ancestors were slaves, right? So this is kind of what you create. Interestingly, Obama and Kamala Harris are both from these communities, right? Kamala Harris's father was a free immigrant from Jamaica. I mean, that was obviously free, but he was an immigrant from Jamaica, a voluntary immigrant from Jamaica. Obama's father, of course, famously came here from Kenya on a specific racially focused scholarship that we were trying to bring in people, and then he eventually repatriated to Kenya. So more than half of young adults in Africa want to immigrate. United States is their dream destination. Somehow the fact that the United States is an oppressive racist hellhole has not made it out to Africa. They seem like very enthusiastic to be here, so they're clearly a lot smarter than a lot of white Democratic voters. African Americans are the wealthiest African population in the world, by far. They're by far richer than the Africans, descendants of the Africans who sold them into slavery. And the same, by the way, goes for pretty much any other ethnic minority community in the country. So, you know, El Salvadorian Americans are infinitely wealthier and better off than El Salvadorans. So there's nothing to really apologize here for, certainly, other than whatever you've done. I mean, we're all sinners, so we've all done bad things. So we've had institutions being captured. Universities have been completely captured by the left. There's almost a trillion dollars in university endowments right now. And those are totally controlled by the radical left. And they are used, to create this legitimizing ideology. And you know, for every one person up me, this is why I want the book to get out there, writing a book like that, academia can pay literally 100 people to like tell you why this book is wrong or just to like create a bunch of false information. You know, I'm very fortunate that I do have a think tank that employs me, but for a lot of folks, it's just a labor of love to do something like this because we have no such institutions on the right. Same is largely true of U.S. charitable foundations. This is the thing on the right is from my Substack, which I would highly encourage you to subscribe to for free and read. Does anybody know who Mackenzie Scott is in the audience? Is that a name that means anything? Okay, you do? Can you say who she was for the... Yeah, so it's Jeff Bezos' ex-wife. So she got, I think, only a third or 25% in the divorce settlement. You can imagine how much that is. She has literally given away, at this point, tens of billions of dollars to some of it's gone for food banks and other things that like nobody would object to. But a huge amount of it has gone to the most marginal, crazy anti-white organizations you could possibly imagine, who now are effectively kind of fronts for her. Now, she'll never deal with that. As I pointed out, she lives in 95% white Medina, Washington, under armed guards, and I'm not exaggerating. But everybody else has to deal with the fact that she's fronting this. So I wrote an article for my Substack that got quite a bit of attention on that really investigated her charitable donations. But so she is writ large the problem we have with these U.S. charitable foundations, $1.2 trillion under assets. Now, of course, some of these are the March of Dimes, okay? So these, not all of these are bad, but pretty much most of, if you were to run down the top 25 foundations by assets, they're pretty much all involved in pretty bad anti-white stuff and have been for a long time. Very little of this is organic, okay? It is directed into a significant degree. So I use Mackenzie Scott as an example of that far left philanthropy. So reparations in progress, Black Californians, this is the stuff that's being debated right now in California and San Francisco very seriously by the legislature. So this is not just like a bunch of weird people at some third-tier university talking about stuff in the coffee lounge. This is stuff that's actively being done by the government. Amos Brown, who's a prominent African-American minister in San Francisco, said America must admit its sin. And what I think is interesting about this biblical thing is it's a recapitulation of the curse of Ham, right? This from the Bible, right? Like it's but just reversed. It's this idea that somehow there's this inherited sin, except this time, you know, before it was wrong, and we said, oh, it was African-descended people who had the curse of Ham. Now it's white people who have the curse of, I don't know, you know, pick your white figure from the Bible that we were supposed to have as a hereditary blood guilt. And Thomas Sowell, who I've pictured here, and I'm sure many of you have heard of him or read his stuff, was a big inspiration for me in writing this book. And in fact, one of the first inklings I had to write this book was 20 years ago. I was living in India at the time with my wife. And I read Sowell's book, Affirmative Action Around the World, an Empirical Study. And it was really something that kind of contextualized for me some of the same types of programs they have in India, but they're not done around race, they're done around caste and other things, and kind of their parallels to what's going on in the US. So as Sowell writes, the quest for cosmic justice, in other words, to make everything perfect, or we might say divine justice, being administered by humans invariably causes greater injustice. So reparations beyond black and white. Black reparations are the medical marijuana of reparations policies, I would argue. Well, what do I mean by that? Medical marijuana was how the pro-drug people got the camel's nose under the tent to make marijuana legal. As soon as, you know, I have a friend who legitimately uses marijuana and says it's the only thing that he has totally debilitating migraines, and marijuana, he said, was the only thing that worked to do it. So, you know, you can always find these edge medical cases for any bad drug almost, that there's a legitimate medical use, right? But that's not ever why it was pushed. It wasn't pushed for the few people like my friend who might have had some legitimate medical use for it. It was pushed because that was the first step to drug legalization, and then they kind of went whole hog as soon as they got the camel's nose under the tent. So similarly, black reparations, the camel's nose, as soon as you say, well, gosh, slavery was really bad, which, you know, headline, it was. Jim Crow was really bad, headline, it was. But as soon as you acknowledge that and say, oh, okay, well, we're going to throw in racial reparations, there's all sorts of other things that you've just opened the door for. So for Asian Americans, you might have the Chinese Exclusion Act of the 1880s, limitations on citizenship, which existed in the 20th century. So Hispanics, Operation Wetback, that was the big deportation program under Eisenhower. The Mexican-American War, which in many ways was not the world's justest war that the U.S. ever fought. And in fact, a lot of people, including Abraham Lincoln, said so at the time. Native Americans, we have wars, broken treaties, land dispossession. Point is, if you create, I'm giving you the prosecutor's case right now, right? I could give you the other case, but I'm giving you the prosecutor's case. The entire white population in a world in which reparations ideology is accepted becomes a lower caste with liabilities in the trillions, right? That's where this is going. The expropriation, as I said, will likely, at least for the foreseeable future, be indirect because direct is messier. It's more obvious. It kind of activates the immune system of white voters. So you'll do various things to hide it. like the mortgage thing, that you lose a little bit of efficiency because it ends up not being a pure racial transfer, but it's easier to win politically. So that's how I think it'll go up. So where does this come up? You have things like land acknowledgments. And if you don't know what a land acknowledgement is, then you're happier than me. Because I sit on a state board in Montana, and I'm not going to mention which one it is because I have certain obligations to not besmirch the organization that I'm involved with. But we give a land acknowledgement over the objection of myself and the other gubernatorial appointees. The other appointees are national appointees, before every meeting. And the land acknowledgements are essentially you're acknowledging that you're on the traditional lands of X native tribe and that you're trespassing in some way. I mean, it depends. I mean, there's a million different ways to give land acknowledgements. But the basic idea is you're acknowledging that basically you're on somebody else's land, okay? We open our meetings, again, state of Montana organization here, state, federal, with this land acknowledgement. And I am like the skunk at the garden party because I raise my hand and politely say that these are racist and we shouldn't do them. Now, these are absurd logically. Multiple lands have been claimed by multiple tribes in warfare over countless generations. Many tribes were exterminated entirely. But as I say in the book, we'd like to honor the Chippewa who drove out the Sioux out of their ancestral lands into new lands where they could massacre the Pawnee, Omaha, and Kiowa. Just doesn't sound as touchy-feely as anti-white leftists would like it to be. Now, again, that is not, none of this is an attempt to besmirch Montana's or America's Native American history, which should absolutely be acknowledged, or these tribes. The point is, war and conquest is a human universal. It's a universal of the human condition since Cain slew Abel, right? That's just what it is. There is nothing unique about the fact that European settlers came, and sometimes legally, you know, through treaty, and sometimes through conquest or through breaking treaties or whatever, took a bunch of land and did things with it. So land acknowledgments are very much trying to set up a mental model. Oh, if I'm trespassing on somebody's land, then I owe them something, right? So Montana and the incoherence of land acknowledgments, sorry, this is a little bit, but I kind of touched on this before, so sorry for the small text. This is a very thinly populated land, especially east of us. Most homesteading failed because there was nothing special about the land. I mean, it's beautiful, right? But this is a harsh, unsparing environment, as we all know who live here, particularly before we had beautiful things like paved roads and heat and all these other things. And the settlers who settled here, including probably some of your ancestors, were incredibly hardy and hardworking folks, and that was the only way they made it, right? And when you do a land acknowledgement, you're basically wiping that away. You're wiping out, you're erasing the white pioneers of Montana, and you're saying, and these failed, again, as I point out, well into the 20th century, we had farms failing in Montana. You're kind of just saying, oh, there's something inherent about the land here that really created all the nice things we enjoy in Montana today. So, you know, instead of being appreciative for people who effectively carved out this modern society out of the wilderness, we besmirched them. Montana became a valuable part of America because of these overwhelmingly white, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly white settlers who built farmsteads, ranches, and roads, strung electric wires over inhospitable territory, and survived brutally cold winters where the temperatures were regularly 30 below zero or worse. So the point is, when we do a land acknowledgement and pretend that there was something just mystical about just there being land here, all that is implicitly being erased. And it's just to say, oh, like all this stuff that you have now, you somehow owe somebody else. So what's the left's end game in all this? So David Brooks from the New York Times, whenever there's something in the New York Times, you can pretty much bet on it being wrong. David, he's not always wrong. David Brooks is not the worst offender here, okay, but I'm just gonna pick on him because when I was looking for wokeness has peaked on the internet, this little thing came up. Wokeness has not even begun. That's maybe another core message of my talk tonight. Anti-white racism has not even begun, okay? If I were giving you this talk 20 years ago, 20 years from now, if I weren't under armed guard or something, this will all be obvious to a much bigger group of people. It's just gonna be no way to hide it. Part of the reason I wrote this book is because I wanna hopefully help put a stop to this in whatever small way I can before it gets to that point. But the anti-white stuff is just beginning because whites still have a lot of political power in this country. Okay, they've got a lot of political power, a lot of economic power. You can't just overtly steamroll whites and get away with it, okay? You have to couch it in all this other stuff that I've been talking about. That's gonna change, okay? And that's gonna change because demography is changing. And whites are gonna have to organize to prevent state-sanctioned theft. And by that, I don't mean that there's some sort of like white nationalism that needs to happen here. It's just in the same way that Martin Luther King organized whites or blacks and allied whites to stop discrimination against his own community, whites are gonna have to organize whites and allied minorities, and there are a lot. I mean, a number of minority reviewers were very kind to give good reviews of this book, to protect our community. It's just that simple. We're already subsidizing our erasure through this uncontrolled immigration that Joe Biden is doing very intentionally, and expropriation is next on the menu. So what are the consequences of all this? Deaths of despair, so-called. So this is Angus Deaton, who's a Nobel Prize-winning economist at Princeton, and his wife, Anne Case, also a distinguished economist, have kind of noticed, and again, you see this, that suddenly among whites of middle age and up, you began to get this huge explosion of what's called deaths of despair, starting around 2000 and really accelerating. And what these so-called deaths of despair are drugs and alcohol, suicide, other related things like this. A little way similar to what happened, again, to Native Americans in the early part of the 20th century. They saw their culture being taken away, their land and traditional practices were being taken away, and they, you know, they turned to the bottle and other things, right? So Case and Deaton document this, and it was one of the things that Deaton won his Nobel Prize for a few years ago. So it's a very interesting result. You see it really dramatically. You're beginning to now see it in some other groups, so maybe the effect is slightly weakening, but certainly at first, this was a phenomenon that we were seeing in whites, but not other groups. You see it a lot in Montana, okay? If you look at the statistics in here in Montana, you see a lot of it. And we have a very high suicide and drug overdose death rate at baseline, but it's gotten worse. So the epidemic, sort of the darker shaded areas are worse here. I do just have to point out, because this is a sort of how to lie with statistics, you'll see some of those dark red areas in eastern Montana. I wouldn't ignore that, but I also wouldn't pay too much attention to it, because the N here is so small. In other words, the number of people that, like, one or two deaths, it's a little bit like the unfortunately deceptive thing that show, you know, all the country voted for Trump, and there's just these tiny little swaths of things that people voted for Clinton or Biden. Well, but a lot of people live in those things. So it's not that these charts show nothing. I mean, I think it does actually show a meaningfully higher rate of this in the Intermountain West, but I wouldn't go too crazy with, you know, some individual county with 2,000 people in eastern Montana that has a huge little bump of geography but doesn't have as many people. So what are solutions? Okay, so the first one I would call for is called White Shifting America's Ethnicity, that I call for in the book. I'm basing this off a British-Canadian scholar named Eric Kaufman. He's himself multiracial, but kind of white phenotypically, if that makes sense. If you looked at him, you would be able to tell he has some Hispanic and Asian ancestry, but he sort of presents as white. But he wrote this really interesting book called Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. And what he effectively calls for is a white shift, that you're gonna take these groups of people, many of them are gonna be Hispanics, that's the most obvious one, I'll get into why that is, some of whom are gonna be Asian, some of whom are gonna be multiracial, and you're gonna get them, you're gonna do things with policy that get them to encourage them to identify themselves with the historic European majority of America. Now, that may sound crazy, this sort of thing happens all the time. Another word for it is called ethnogenesis, that's what scholars would say. It's how you create an ethnic group, which is separate from a race, but a group of people that come to see themselves as one people, even though, of course, white Americans, the Americans who would call themselves white today, come from a huge variety of European backgrounds, many of whom would have been at war with each other for a variety of reasons in Europe, right? So you white shift. And so Eric Kaufman has written this very interesting book that I recommend to folks who are interested in exploring this. It's a little, I mean, my book, I try to be pretty even-handed. Eric is even more even-handed because he's in academia. So even though he gets in trouble, but he really tries to be more careful. Hispanics, which are an overwhelmingly by descent European origin group overall, although obviously it's heterogeneous, a third of them are intermarrying with white non-Hispanics already. This is the most natural constituency for this. By the way, they also, of course, have a long history in the United States, particularly in the Southwest. But there are other groups you could do it just to. But of course, the Census Bureau, because Biden isn't an idiot and he wants to divide us, is working exactly the reverse. For the 2030 census, and hopefully under Trump we'll be able to undo this, but we'll have to see. Just last week they announced something that is going to make white, basically Middle Easterners are now carved out of the white group. That's where they have been. So interestingly, Middle Easterners had already had kind of this thing. You know, Casey Kasem, a guy like that who was Lebanese, but kind of coded as white for everybody. He hosted American Top 40. He was this very American guy from the Detroit area. So we're now trying to carve out a new category for these folks so that we can have just one more group that kind of can get resources while whites don't. So this is the exact opposite. In fact, we should try to be folding in more people into this majority over time because it'll make it a more durable majority. I mean, if you could get the substantial majority of Hispanics, and by the way, I mean, on the census, because Hispanic is not listed as an ethnicity, that's another thing they're messing with, it's considered an ethnicity and not a race. The substantial majority of Hispanics in America identify as white Hispanics. Increasingly, they're native-born, many of them, and multi-generations. A lot of those guys are the Trump voters among Hispanics, right? And there's a lot of them. So all we need to do is have the government not working to like make them different, and then we could actually, I think, come together, right? Now, that's not my ideal solution that I would start out with at first, but I think it's my ideal solution for given where we are today. So we have to hold minority racists and white leftists, who are also racist, responsible. We need to start calling them out when they do these ridiculous things. We need to call out the Kendis. We need to call out the Robin DiAngelos. Robin DiAngelo is the person who wrote the book White Fragility, which was another a white woman, and she, you know, makes millions of dollars giving speeches and et cetera. So we need to call out those people. We need to make their lives unpleasant. I mean, it's a very direct confrontation thing. And really, again, I talk about white leftists as really some of the biggest enemies in this book. We need to boycott Hollywood and Madison Avenue on stuff. This is a trailer for Get Out and Do the Right Thing. These are two very anti-white movies that got a great deal of press and did very well. I mean, I could have named 50 others. I'm actually slightly being unfair in that these are actually somewhat artistically interesting movies, but they're sort of racist. I mean, the movie Birth of a Nation, for those of you who know your film history, was probably the most technically important film of the first half of the 20th century, but it was also a film that celebrated the Ku Klux Klan, and therefore it's kind of always been controversial. And D. Griffith, the director of Birth of a Nation, was controversial, and now it's kind of a banned film, even though it was kind of this technical landmark. I think we need to have a similar view toward this. Hamilton, I talk about this a lot in the book, the musical, again, the most popular Broadway musical of the last several decades, if not ever. I don't think we should ban Hamilton or even discourage Hamilton. I think there's a lot of interesting and artistically worthy things about it, but there's also a lot of implicit anti-white ideology within Hamilton, and we should not hesitate to point that out. I also just flag here the white men are stupid in commercials Twitter thing, if you want to see what I'm talking about in the context of how Madison Avenue treats white people, you know, follow their Twitter account. You'll see a regular diet of this type of stuff. Net zero immigration. This is a recent immigration photo. We can't possibly consolidate a new American identity without getting control of our border. I argue what that needs to look like. At least our opening bargaining position should not be, well, you know, illegal, no, but legal, yes, it's great. No, net zero immigration, that's what we want. We'll negotiate from there. We need that if we're going to do any of this white shifting or ethnogenesis or any things I talk about. It requires what we did in 1924, which is we put a stop to immigration and allowed time for a new American identity to emerge out of the people who were here, a new unified identity. So I think that's necessary. Importance of lawfare. This is just one organization. Again, I mentioned that yesterday, Stephen Miller's group, America First Legal, who I definitely think is worth of your support, just in the past month, and this is not even all their stuff, just a little bit of the things they've done. It's like when you see, it's a little bit like watching Ron DeSantis govern Florida, and people like me who are like always frustrated that our governors, GOP governors, seem to be so bad and useless and couldn't figure out, and they're like, well, maybe I'm just wrong. Maybe it's like much harder than I think. And then DeSantis just like went out and did everything, and you're like, no, they just all were terrible. And DeSantis is really good, and this is what it should be. I'd always wondered, like, why are we not doing effective lawfare about all this stuff? And I'm like, well, maybe it's just harder than I think. And then America First Legal comes in and says, nah, It's not actually that hard. You just have to go do it. And they are just racking up win after win. They're suing all these people over these anti-white policies that are completely illegal. And when they're not in front of absolutely crazed Democratic judges, and even a few times when they are, because these things are so illegal on the face of it, they're winning. So, hey, you know, that's a good thing. We need a wholesale reform of civil rights law. The technical details of that are certainly beyond my discussing them here in any detail. And to be quite honest, they're beyond my personal capability to give. I mean, you really would want a lawyer because you can't just sort of wave your hands, even though I do this in the book, and say, oh, you know, kind of need to change it. I'm just trying to give some principles that I think we want here, which is we need to change the presumption of discrimination. The broad way I think we want to think about what a new civil rights law would look like is people have a right to services, okay? Like, I have a right to be able to go to a restaurant, to go to a hotel. Certainly, I have a right to all government services, period, even if, like, you're a group that a lot of people don't like. But people also have a right to free association, and that's what's been lost in my book by Christopher Caldwell. My Claremont colleague talks about this a lot. That's what's been lost in the post-Civil Rights Act regime, is the ability to associate with people you want to. So no more bake me a cake. And for those of you who recognize what this is a reference to as Christians, it's this poor baker in Colorado, this Christian baker, who has refused to bake a cake for a gay wedding. Wasn't refusing to bake cake for gay people, which, by the way, I think he should have been able to do, although I personally wouldn't do it, and he wouldn't do it. But I think he should be able to do that if that's his right. So he is actually the victim here. He's been hounded. You know, he had to go to court. He had to go to the Supreme Court. He finally won at the Supreme Court. Then the trans people started. I mean, he's just, like, the harassment has been never-ending of this guy. And the very simple principle that would avoid all this is to say, look, you guys have 100 other cake people in the Denver, Colorado metro area that you could go to get your cake baked. There's no, you're not being denied a service. You're picking on a businessman who's saying, you know, I'm going to have certain principles, whether those be Christian or whatever, about who I'm going to serve at my establishment. And so something that had those sorts of broad principles is where I think we need to get to. Understanding that whatever justifications we might have had that were totally legitimate in 1964, there is not going to be anybody appreciably who's going to be like, I'm not going to serve black people or Hispanics or whatever at my business in 2024. For many reasons, it's not going to happen. Even if they don't want to, they'll do it, okay? But what you do when you get rid of kind of some of our current laws around this is you make it much harder for frivolous discrimination suits to win. That's what you do. That's what functionally happens. And nobody's denied a service that they legitimately want. But it just means that the presumption is on the person making the suit to prove that they have really been uniquely harmed for some unfair way and that they can't redress this in some other way. And it restores freedom of association to people. And that's where I think we need to work for, whether it be Christian bakers or restaurants or hotels or whatever. Finally, support the police. So law enforcement and public order keeps all communities safer. When we have a lack of strong law enforcement presence, you get things like the Daniel Penny, he was the guy I talked about yesterday on the New York subway, who heroically, in my view, and in most of the vast majority of other people there, stepped in to deal with this crazy person who unfortunately died. But he had to be there because law and order was not being preserved on the New York City subway. Similarly, Kyle Rittenhouse, right? In my view, and ultimately in the view of the jury, acting in self-defense. But the only reason that this 17-year-old was even out on the street with a group of citizens is because the city and state had abandoned their role as the purveyors of public order. So if we encourage public order, it helps everybody in every community, right? Like, this shouldn't even be a racial thing at all, but I think it's a way that we can help. Finally, we should stop apologizing for being white. I literally wrote this tweet this morning because I was, like, slightly annoyed. I saw this tweet that had gone kind of viral with this guy saying, stolen land, and, you know, this was my commentary, and last thing I checked, there was getting a lot of appreciation. So we conquered it, we improved it, we're not sorry, we're not giving you special acknowledgement, and we're not giving it back, right? Like, just not apologizing. I wouldn't be this confrontational in a pleasant interaction with a normal person, but with an obnoxious person like this who's writing stolen land over my entire country, like, yeah, you know, like, don't be afraid to punch back. So that's what I tried to do there just a little bit. So thanks very much for those of you, particularly all those of you who stuck through all four of these. You can find me again on X Twitter at RealJeremyCarl. My Substack, I would love it if you guys signed up for this because it's new, Course of Empire. You can sign up for free, all these publications. And I thank everybody for their time and attention. I'm happy to talk afterwards for a little while and sign books and answer any questions that folks have. So thank you.
We will take a few questions. If you, just a minute. If you have a question, please raise your hand, and Bill, the enforcer, will come to you. While he's doing that, I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name, ex-military, on Fox News this morning, talking about how he went into the military to resist tyrants. Used a different word. Now, he got out of the military because he had become one in the military's eyes. That's how far we've come. And so, Bill, hands in the air, questions?
I got one right here.
I may be the only redneck in this bunch of intellectuals, but what is gaslighting?
Great question, and this is... I'm too online, okay? I have to confess it. I'm not as horrible as like these Gen Z people who are like living their entire existences online. But the term gaslighting is kind of a modern term that's come up largely online. It's from a 1930s movie called Gaslight, in which a woman witnesses her husband, I think, murder somebody. People who've seen the movie Gaslight, it won the Academy Award, maybe you can correct me here. But then basically the husband does all these things to convince her that, in fact, she's crazy. So when you say that you're gaslighting somebody, yeah, it's like they're seeing something right in front of their eyes, and you're just telling them, oh, no, you're not really seeing that. So that's what it means. So thank you for asking that.
The convention of states so far hasn't been really successful in getting all the states for the amendment change, and how would this really affect these things that we've been talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's another one of those things I'm going to throw up my hands and tell you I don't know. I'm always a little bit nervous because as weakened as our Constitution has, as much as it has sort of become a piece of paper, just particularly in the arms of the left that they just ignore, it's still a pretty powerful document. And when you look at, say, I see this on Twitter all the time, the free speech protections we still have, even with all the craziness, even with all the censorship, even with all that in America versus like what they've got in Europe, you know, I'm kind of nervous about opening up that Pandora's box. At the same time, things are getting bad. There's no question. So we may have to at some point break glass in case of emergency, and we'll end up at a conventions of states quite a type level. And of course, one of the things that is kind of interesting in that context is that there is certainly a group of states here in the Great Plains and Northern Rockies where people think a little bit differently and traditionally than, say, they're doing in New York and California. And you could imagine some sort of legal and other type alliance forming among states like that if we were to kind of open up that Pandora's box because we decided there was nothing else to do, but I think it's also got some risk. It's just hard to say. You know, my juncture at this point is to be very nervous with our current populace about trying to think that we could do a better constitution of any type than the one that we've already got, because I think we have a people problem, not a constitution problem. But we may get there. We may get there at some point. So we'll have to see. Anybody else?
Bill.
I'm not terribly politically aware because I like to keep my head in the hole in the ground. But everybody talks about Ron DeSantis, but nobody talks about North Dakota's governor during COVID and what she did. Why do we never hear anything about the positive things that lady did?
South Dakota.
Yeah, so Christy Noem, South Dakota.
Sorry.
She's on Trump's VP shortlist. I don't think she'll be picked for a variety of reasons not worth going into here, but people did. People did pay attention, particularly at the time. I mean, I think just like everything else with COVID, we have a short memory, because if we didn't have a short memory, we'd be stringing people up lampposts right now about some of the things that were done during COVID. But I think people did acknowledge that, and Kristi Noem did some very good things, and then she's done some other things that are not as great. But in no way am I implying that DeSantis is the only person who's done something useful. In fact, a guy like Greg Abbott, he's kind of like a little bit of a squish ideologically, in my view, down in Texas. But when he started doing it, this is like a really interesting thing and why it matters for you guys to participate in the process. Once he started going out a little bit on immigration, and he saw the sort of reaction that he got from the base and how positive it was, he started really developing a little bit of his own courage that he hadn't had before. He got encouraged because he was like, wow, the people will actually be with me if I do stuff. So I think that it absolutely, I really don't like to take shots. I really, particularly in Montana, I don't try to go after people by name, especially since it's a small state, right? Like, I try to really visibly encourage them when they do something I like, and they can determine from my silence when they do something that I don't like. You know, these are people I tend to know in some cases. But yeah, there's other people who are doing good things out there for sure.
Hi, so in Montana, well, Anna's gone on outside of Montana, but nationally, I believe that one of the biggest reparations that took place didn't involve cash, but it involved our water, taken by the federal government in trust of the Native Americans, the Indians, and CSKT Water Compact, if no one knows what I'm talking about. But that is a huge reparations taken from four previous actions. I just like your comment on it.
Well, it's interesting.
Amen.
It's interesting that you mentioned this, because part of this group that I, again, I'm not mentioning the name, that I'm involved with at the state level, we were asked to fund a project called Stolen Waters that implied, in fact, sort of the reverse of what you said, that said that, like, in fact, white people had stolen all these native water rights. And myself and another lady on the board, one of the few gubernatorial appointees who is a rancher who's very, very familiar with the water rights history of Montana, objected very, very vociferously to us funding this project. And again, because our government, not at the state, but at the national level, is run by a bunch of communists, we were not successful in that objection. But yeah, I mean, I'm aware of it. There's all sorts of things. And this is exactly, by the way, the sort of thing that's going to happen. So in the Southwest, you're already seeing things. Again, this is, it's so below the radar, which is how our government loves to work. Things where traditional grazing rights are being restored to communities on public lands, right, which are in fact massive takings with dubious legal backing for doing them. So I think these are absolutely things where we need smart people, smart citizens, and smart people running the government who are paying attention.
Are you suggesting that the Bureau of Land Management might be lefties?
It's a friend of mine ran it under Trump when I was in Interior, who was definitely not a lefty, and he was at war with the entire BLM.
Next question. Somebody? Up here.
You know, when Biden, you know, invited people here to America, and you've got hordes of people coming from all over the world, and different people have different intentions,
sure.
Do you think some of these people actually want to be Americans? And I mean, we're such a horrible country, but they still want to come here.
Yeah.
So...
Sure. I mean, and this is why I really try to avoid, whenever I talk about the immigration issue, I really try to avoid immigrant bashing, because I don't blame them. I mean, there are some minority, and it's also the reason I don't love the rhetoric of, oh, they're letting in terrorists, which, I mean, of course they are, and we should talk about that, but that's not the point. Like, even if none of them are terrorists, the question is, does it help us to have them there? But I also think it's not useful or helpful, usually, to accuse the people coming here for the most part of having bad motives. I think most of them want to be Americans or in some form or fashion. The question is simply, like, does their presence here likely to add, it goes back to my James Madison quote in immigration, Does it add to our country on average, or does it not? So it doesn't really matter what they want. That's not the relevant thing for what our decision needs to be. You know, like, I would have loved to have been a tenured member of the Harvard faculty. Like, for ideological and other reasons, that's never going to happen, right? So we have to be the people making that choice. I don't immigrant bash myself. I bash the people who are letting our border wide open. And I think that's what the focus needs to be.
I just wanted to ask, you've probably mentioned this, but can that interview that you did with Tucker Carlson be found?
So it's just not released yet. So I taped it March 28th. They told me a couple weeks, which to me means like 2 or 3 weeks. So it's been a week. I'd expect in the next week or two, it'll be in Tucker on Twitter. So if you follow Tucker on Twitter, or if you follow me on Twitter, I will certainly be talking about it, and it'll be out there. It'll be like 25 minutes. And then I'll be sitting down with Charlie Kirk, which will be another big interview on the 16th of April for an hour to talk about the book. So you guys are you guys are getting the first public cut at it before I get to talk to any of these guys. So.
Hi, I just have an observation kind of to share. You know, the dilution of our Constitution, and then also those that choose to ignore a big part of it and think maybe we need to just ignore it or whatever. It kind of reminds me of those in our country that believe that the world that believe that the Bible is outdated, like the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Commandments, but yeah, I mean, the Lord laid out to us, oh, that's just outdated, you know, it's not appropriate for today. And not that the Bible is anywhere near, you know, what the Constitution is in importance. I don't want anybody to think that, but just that dilution of it, that it doesn't apply to today's world. Yeah. And I have my own family members that have said that type of thing.
Sure. Well, it reminds me of G.K. Chesterton, who's a wonderful Catholic writer who maybe some of you have read. And he has a great thing that he does called Chesterton's Fence. And I really, like, just if you write that down and Google it, like, it's one of the great things about maintaining, the importance of maintaining tradition. And I won't go into what it all is here, but one of the things he points out is he talks about all the people who say all this stuff is outdated, and he says, well, perhaps it is true that your forefathers were fools, but maybe you should consider that their foolishness might be hereditary. You know, I think that's just the right way to think about any tradition, right? We should, for all sorts of reasons, we believe in the Bible, right? But, like, even the Constitution, it's been here for 200 and whatever years. America, for all of its faults, has done pretty well under that governance. So let's be really careful. And certainly, if anybody says, like, oh, get rid of it because there's no reason for it, that person you should just ignore. If somebody comes up with true humility and says, gosh, this was so amazing, it did so many good things, it still does some good things, I have some concerns about X and Y, maybe not, even though they worked in the past, working for now, then you can have a discussion with that person about maybe, you know, the substance of what they're arguing. Yeah.
Other questions? It's snowing outside. Did you know that?
Yeah, I'm wondering about my kid's soccer game.
I forgot the question I was going to ask. It took so long for your guy to get here.
Cheer up, Tony. That's going to get worse as you get older.
So there has been a movement in several areas to reinforce the teaching of civics in schools. So a lot of the abandonment of American rights and privileges because we don't know about them. From your perspective, do you see that there is really any movement towards civics instruction in schools increasing, or is it decreasing, or
I think
how is that?
Gianforte's maybe even done a little bit here in Montana. I can't remember the specific bills, but I do think there's been some things that have been done. I think my baseline concern, even though I think civics teaching is great and I think we should do it, is who's going to teach the civics, right?
Amen.
You know, I think the who-whom questions never go away. And that's just the reality of where we are. And there's no system. It's one of the reasons I'm really for school choice, because it allows us to put our own money toward the sort of schooling that we want for it. Because I don't think we're ever going to fix. I think the left just has a strangle on government schools. So, like, let's be able to pay our own folks. We're the ones having kids, by the way, to support our schools. So thank you guys very much. I'd love to talk with you afterwards.
I think the answer to that is parents need to teach civics.
Yeah.
Jeremy, I don't know who got a hold of this. I gave the wrong name. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
What do you think of this?
Yeah.